Hello, Dental Online Trainers, and welcome to the Dental Online Training Sharecast. I'm your host, Dr. Dennis Hartlieb. Each month, I'll be talking with dental experts who are doing amazing work in the field of dentistry and talk about how they got to be where they are today, what their influences were, and their journey in the world of dentistry. And as a bonus, I'll occasionally throw in a few of my solo bonding sharecasts, where I share a little of my experience with you about what's going on in my practice and lessons that I've learned along the way. So tune in every other week to hear our latest episode. Hello, Dental Online Trainers. I'm Dr. Dennis Hartlieb, back with another of our wonderful sharecasts. In today's episode, I'm really very excited to bring on a guest, someone who I've just known about for literally decades, our paths have never crossed until just recently. This is Dr. Gary DeWood. And Gary was kind enough, there was a post-equilibration hanging out at the bar at the...
We were at the Marriott. Yes.
And Gary came over to introduce himself and say hello. And I was so grateful. And I've heard so much about Gary. And I've been really, actually, you were one of the names I had, several people have sent me messages on Instagram saying, hey, could you interview this person? Could you interview this person? And your name had come up more than once. And I was looking for an opportunity to reach out to you. And it was just good happenstance that you happened to come over and say hello. And here we are today. So welcome to our Sharecast, Gary. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's wonderful to be here, Dennis. Thank you for the invitation. You know, I would say the same thing about you. You are one of those people that I've read stuff and I see stuff and I hear stuff from people. And I remember thinking, everything that I heard made me say, I think I'd like to know him better. And unfortunately, for me, nothing kind of conspired, because as you said, stuff just sort of happens in life. And I was really happy that I heard somebody talking over right next to me and said your name. And I looked over and I said, that's him. So I'm really happy that I went over and said, hey, well, I've been wanting to meet you for the last 25 years.
Yeah, same.
Sorry, it took me so long.
My good friend, Kathy French, who is in one of my study clubs and practices close to me, she's just raved about you for so long, and so many other people too. But Kathy's such a big fan of yours and stuff, and so many other people. So I'm so grateful that you'll hang out and share your experiences with us. So I wore a special hat for you today. So Gary, grew up in a town called Toledo, Ohio, and a little geography lesson for those out there, if you're not familiar with the Great Lakes states. So Toledo, Ohio is just southeast corner of the great state of Michigan. That's our national championship Michigan Wolverine state. And so it's like, I mean, an hour's distance from Detroit, Michigan. So quite close.
Right.
And so I'm wearing a Stroh's baseball cap. Stroh's is a beer from Detroit. And so not a lot of people know about Stroh's, but I figured Gary would. So I wanted to make sure that I wore my hat in honor of you.
Appreciate that. I know a lot about Stroh's and their ice cream.
Oh, right. Exactly. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Right. Beer flavored ice cream. How about that?
Well, so I did that business during Prohibition and never got out of it, because you can still get Stroh's ice cream.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah, I'll tell you a little geography lesson more for those out there. So Toledo is this little city just southeast corner of Detroit, and it used to be part of Michigan. And there was this great battle, the Ohio-Michigan battle, over this strip of land where Toledo is in. And it was like there was a lot of pushing and shoving and name-calling. I don't know that anyone actually was like injured over this battle for the strip of the Toledo land. But the good news for Michigan is we got the Upper Peninsula as we seceded that strip of land over to the state of Ohio.
And I learned about that, actually. That was a kind of a point of history in Toledo. And it was actually between two territories. They were not really officially states yet. And it was actually a declared, quote unquote, war. No shots were fired.
Right.
And no one was injured.
Just pushing and shoving. Good old rivalry. It's sort of like the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry today. No shots are fired, just a lot of pushing and shoving and name calling.
Amen to that.
So the Toledo people are sort of honorary Michiganders because many of them are still more connected to the state of Michigan and the Detroit area, even though they live in that awful state of Ohio. And Gary, I think you're one of them because I believe that you used to travel up to Michigan for relaxation and recreation when you were a kid, right?
Actually, when I as I grew up, my parents had us at a cottage on one of the lakes in the Irish Hills up near Brooklyn, and so I spent most summers in Michigan. When I was really young, Michigan was actually at the end of our backyard because we're right on the border there, and so I would, it didn't matter. I never really thought about what state you were in because most of my life was in Michigan. And officially, as I've grown older, and I happen to be a Michigan fan, and I'm the oldest of six, I will tell you that there are five Buckeyes in my family.
We all have our black sheeps in our family. There's nothing, you can't pick family. This is they are what they are. So no apologies necessary for what family decided to do.
I got lucky in that years ago, the big all of the Big Ten schools had Boy Scout troops that ushered to their football games. So when I was first in scouting, I spent every Saturday there was a home game in Ann Arbor as an usher in Michigan Stadium.
Oh, cool.
So I was like, I mean, the first time I went, I think I was 11.
Wow.
And I really got to enjoy Michigan, watching Michigan football, and got lucky, sort of. I met the young lady who sat down next to me my first day of dental school. Her name was Cheryl Davis. So because we were alphabetically in order,
Yeah.
we became really, really good friends. At the end of 2 years, we decided it would probably be cheaper to buy one book, so we got married.
Ah. Smart move. Good financial move.
And we are still married.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Been fun. And Cheryl is from Belleville, Michigan, which is right up
I know Belleville.
by the airport outside Detroit. She grew up in Ypsilanti and in Belleville, and her father is an accountant, and he was at General Motors, but he was finishing school, and I wound up with a PhD in accounting and a PhD in education, and then he headed the MBA program at the University of Michigan for a little while, and had. From his initial involvement at the school, had season tickets,
Nice.
so we still have four of them. Cheryl's mom has those now, and we don't get back to as many games as I would like, but I am still an absolute Michigan fan. I love, I one of the things that really excited me about you was that, of course, I kept hearing from other people that you were Go Blue.
Yeah, I
It's
am.
fun to
Yes.
be Go Blue people. We're just way more fun than everybody
We
else.
are. Right. All you Buckeyes out there, you eat it. This is you know what? This is fantastic. We might just talk about Michigan football all day. Yeah, and this is a great time for us to be very proud of
Indeed.
our heritage and lineage, right?
Indeed. It is. It's
Yeah.
fun to be a Michigan fan right now. There was a lull in there, but there's been lulls in the past too. You get that's kind of the fun of it all, I guess. I've never been so I don't feel defeated when we lose. I just figure that's part of what happens sometimes.
Right,
As long as we play a good game, that's all that matters.
but it is awfully nice winning.
Oh, always.
All right, listen, let's so before we talk about dentistry and stuff, the thing that I'm super curious about and the thing that that strikes me about you is, Gary, I know how much of your career you spent in teaching. And as I understand, you have a teaching degree from Bowling Green, right?
I do. My degree is in education from Bowling Green State University.
Now, is there education in your family background, or how is it that you were led down into that track, or was there dentistry in your background, or sort of walk me in through getting your teaching degree at Bowling Green first, and how that was like in your family, how that was sort of happened, and then I'm curious how then you moved into dentistry.
So I was highly influenced by two teachers in high school. I went to Toledo St. John's. Both of them were Jesuit priests, and they were teachers. And I just remember They made what they were teaching me interested. And in hindsight, as I've learned, I realized, you know, I was interested. And of course, that helped build the relationship. But the biology teacher and the chemistry teacher became good friends. And I remember thinking, you know, this is something I think I could really enjoy doing. Bowling Green is a teacher college. It was officially, you know, Ohio and Michigan both had these. Had colleges that were absolutely, that's all you went there for was education. Bowling Green was one of those when it was founded. And of course, it grew into more than that, as did the others, like Eastern Michigan was originally your college. And they focused on that. And while I was there, I did go to college for a couple of years, but I went in with the intention of being a biology teacher because I really enjoyed biology a lot. Like chemistry too. I wound up actually also with a physics major. So I have biology, chemistry, and physics majors in education. So I liked all of those. It took me longer than 4 years, but I'll come back to that. I went with that intention. And again, it was because of the influence. And I found out I really did enjoy that interaction with people. And
you
of course,
planning, at that time, were you thinking like going to high school, or were you thinking about teaching at a collegiate level, or where was your head?
I was definitely aimed at teaching in a high school somewhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I had as my vision. After a year of college, let's just say that I started to be unsure why I was there.
Okay.
So I left. A buddy and I bought a van and built some things in the back so we could live and sleep in the back if we had to. And I went out and drove around out west and wound up going up and down California and drove up the Alcan before it was paved all the way through Alaska, up to Alaska.
No way.
This was in the, well, this would have been in
70s?
The 70s. Yeah. Like in high school in 1970. So this would have been 1971 and 2. And I was kind of just traveling around out west and came back and just got a job at Whirlpool Corporation in Findlay, Ohio.
Well, how long did you travel? How long were you on the road?
Oh, probably about 22 months.
No, so 2 years you're on the road.
Yeah, kind of just out stuff.
And so what'd you guys do for money? How'd you afford to do this?
Got jobs.
So you would travel, you'd drive out to California, and then you
had a relative in California and had an uncle in Las Vegas. Actually, I made a bunch of money in Vegas because we stopped. And at that time, the original MGM Grand Hotel was being built.
Okay.
My dad's uncle, actually, my grandfather's youngest brother. So he's more of an uncle age for me. He was the entertainment director at the Aladdin Hotel.
Okay.
He worked with Danny Thomas Productions and stuff. Because I don't know if you knew this, but Amos Jacobs is from Toledo, Ohio. The name everybody knows him by or heard him by was Danny Thomas.
Ah.
Got out there. And my dad's uncle, my Uncle Mitch, had left Toledo together and were in show business. And so he worked with him actually throughout his life. So when we got there, you know, a couple of things, we stopped to visit and he basically said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'd love to find some work for a while. And he goes, well, I can find you something to do. So we were gophers on the site of the original MGM Grand Hotel and made quite a bit of money.
No kidding.
But the most memorable part of that was that at that time, there was really no strip.
Right.
The Tropicana was there.
Yeah.
You drove past a mile of desert to drive out to the Tropicana. There was nothing on the strip. It was everything was downtown.
Right.
And the entertainment directors was a very small group of people. There weren't like piles of big casinos that had lots of big entertainment. And so they would get together once a month and audition shows. They'd pick a hotel and at night. So this would start like at 1 a.m.
Okay.
And my uncle said, you know, if you guys are willing to do this and, you know, once a month you can plan for this, you can come in and stay and watch the shows and you can tell us what you think. We'd love to just hear from you guys.
Right.
People, they would bring people. And it was really fun because we loved it because they would give you anything you wanted to eat or drink. So at first, of course, we were ridiculous about that.
No doubt.
I know.
Right.
Fortunately, I realized that the next day wasn't worth it.
So, for people who are not watching this, you should see how big my eyes are as you're talking about getting free food and drink when you're 20-some years old, right? I mean, this is like, is this nirvana or what?
This is what heaven's like.
Right? Wow. So who did you see? Like, what shows do you remember seeing or performers do you remember seeing coming through?
So back then, I don't remember anybody who is like a name thing today. Most of them were show business productions. They were group things where they had a lot of stuff coming through. But I do remember this because my uncle would, you know, anytime we wanted to go see a show, we could just ask. So the biggest thing that happened was I got to see Elvis several times.
Wow. Cool.
And we usually sat in the manager's box, which is in the middle of the stage. And it was just awesome. But the biggest thing I learned was this. There was one person who I saw, who I remember even at the time thinking, there is no way I'm going to like this. Because Wayne Newton was new.
Right.
Young guy there. And it's like, really? It was excellent. This is what I learned. People who are good entertainers, it doesn't matter if you would never buy that record. You will enjoy the show.
Interesting.
And that has stood true for my whole life. I've recognized that. So the same kind of a thing.
Yeah.
One of the things, I just said this actually day before yesterday. Somebody asked me, I'm teaching down at the Pankey Institute. Somebody in the group said, you know, you have a lot of energy and interactions with people. How do you do that? And they said, I love it. I mean, for me, I honestly believe that dentistry is performance art.
Yeah, right. No doubt.
I want to be like going to the theater. People go to the theater, you want them to leave with some kind of an experience that allows them to have some thoughts about something.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to do.
Interesting.
And I learned that if you could be good at that part of it, that's the difference between being a surgeon.
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to say a restorative dentist, because we generally work with people who are alive, conscious.
Yep.
And I hope at least enjoying being present, if they wouldn't say they enjoy the experience. But so many of them say they enjoy the experience. You know, if somebody says to me, God, I hate going to the dentist. Love coming to see you. Okay, I'm good with that.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So anyway, you know, that's what I learned mostly from that was that. And the most memorable ones, I went to some kind of last generation entertainers that I really, really enjoyed. You know, that was near the end of the Rat Pack stuff, but they were all still there. So I saw all those people live. And
Sammy Davis Jr. and
yes. And all of them, they were just really, really, really good. And then one of the other most memorable ones that lots of times at my uncle's house, lots of those people would come over for dinner.
Oh, how cool.
Before, you know, just they come in their jeans.
Right.
Show up at the house. I mean, it was kind of what you said at the beginning. We were talking a little bit just about, you know, people are people.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be really good. You have to learn that because you get a vision of somebody being different or special because of how you've experienced and what you've experienced with them. And so some of the time it's so much fun to be able to have that other side of that.
Right.
Whereas, you know, this is my cousin's, would be my dad's cousin, but my cousin's godfather who's walking in, right? It just happens to be Dean Martin.
Right.
Who I saw on TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of stuff. So,
you know, for our young listeners, you might want to pull out Wikipedia and you can, or Google Wayne Newton, Sammy Davis Jr.,
yes.
Dean Martin, or you can call your parents or your grandparents and they can give you a little background story on some of these very influential performers that, you know, really shaped our country in so many ways back in the day. And you got to be there. I'm so envious because my path was so linear. And currently, so I do some sailing and I've been just doing a deep dive into these guys who do these solo sails, and they'll solo sail across the Atlantic and they'll solo sail across the Med. And they have, you know, now with YouTube and stuff, and I'm just like, I'm enjoying just sort of imagining sort of having that freedom and just going about. And so when I hear sort of this vagabond story where you retrofitted a van and you're going across the country, destination unknown, for time unknown, super liberating. And so getting back to it, so you're at school for a year, it's while you had this intention and stuff like that, you weren't, it wasn't, and I think the 70s were sort of part of that generation too, where there was a whole lot of going on, right? You got Vietnam that was, that cycled out, and there's a lot of distrust of authority. There's a lot of distrust of normalcy. And so, like, I'm just so curious, like, well, where your head was, what you were thinking as you're going about this journey across country for a couple of years. Do you remember?
Well, I guess what I kept thinking was I was uninterested in kind of the things at school. And I don't, because I lost sight of sort of when I picked being a biology teacher, it's just because it made sense. And then once I got there and started doing stuff, it wasn't that I started to second guess it. It was just that, is that what I really want to do? And
Yeah.
not to say I know I would like it. I know I would enjoy that. But the guy that actually a guy that I met in my dorm, and so we shared a room in the second semester. We were on quarters in the second quarter, and he was just he needed to get away. And I said that would be awesome. I mean, because I honestly I had never been, well, hell, I'd never been west of Chicago,
Right.
ever,
Yeah.
and so. That was what drew me.
Yeah.
So he said, "Well, we could do this, this, and this." And back then, you really could work and save enough money to go to college.
Yeah.
So I had, and I was doing that because I'm the oldest of six. My parents didn't have money to give me to go to school.
Sure.
So we, you were, and you really could do it. You could work in a summer and save enough, have a job during school. Be a full-time job,
Right.
weekends, eat some evenings, and you can make enough money to live and do okay. And so we already had that sort of belief that you could make enough money to be okay wherever you went because you're going to
Yeah.
find jobs to do. And I think that that was a big part of it. It was just like, well, my parents were a little bit upset. And I don't mean, I think I think they were hurt in a lot of ways. No one on my mother's side of the family or my father's side of the family had ever graduated from college. And one of my mom's goals, which is a whole nother story, but my mother's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And when she finished high school, she wanted to go to college so bad because she loved learning. Still, she still loves. She's 90 years old. And I go visit and she gets out of, she picks up a book. Have you read this?
Great. That's awesome.
I said, "No, you need to read this."
Oh, I want
That
that.
can't stop.
So cool.
So as I get older now, and now when she does that to me, I say, "So what are you learning?"
Yeah.
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 So anyway, let's just say she didn't have that. And she finally did get a college degree. She was 74 when she got her college degree.
How cool.
And so she was kind of almost, I hate to say, devastated. And she was just like, "I'm just afraid you'll never go back."
Sure.
And I said, at the time I'm young, I'm graduating. I was 17 when I graduated from high school. So I turned 18, actually, when I was still there. It was, and my birthday is at the end of September. So I turned 18 when I was already in college. And so it wasn't like I was grown up for at all,
Right.
knowing what I know now. But I wasn't even officially a grown up because back then we're 21 anyway, forever. But at 18, they did at least cut you enough slack to say in Ohio you could buy 3-2 beer, so you've
Right.
grown up enough for
Yeah.
that. And I did. You feel like a grown up,
Sure
and 18
do.
is sort of the age when you're a grown up, supposed to be that. And I remember I said to my mom, "I'll go back." And in hindsight, what I keep thinking is, knowing what you know now, and you look back at how she must have felt, is she knew that the odds were that I probably would.
Yeah.
For me, that was non-existent. I was going to do whatever. And I'm really happy I did it. I learned a lot of incredible stuff about myself and about the world. And I will never forget pulling up to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, because it is the one thing in the full journey that to this day I can clearly see in my mind every time I think about it.
Wow.
There was this feeling of awe and this feeling of insignificance
Right?
at the
So
same
true.
time. It was like, wow,
Right?
this is just one little hole, quote unquote, in one little planet. I remember this vividly, thinking this at the time. And I had taken I had a camera, an Instamatic. Now that's another one you can look up on Wikipedia.
Right. Did the Google.
Most of you listening have no clue what that would be. I still remember walking up to the Grand Canyon and looking out at this thing. And the first time I just saw it, I just put the camera in my pocket, never shot a picture while I was there. And because somewhere in my head, I said, there's no way.
Yeah, right. It won't give it justice.
For that reason alone, that moment of sort of clarity about my position in the universe, I'm glad I did that.
I tell you, for the
reality, the whole trip was stuff like that, as you know. It would have taken me longer to have that experience if I had stayed back, finished school, started doing something. And I would have. I have no doubt that I would have. I'm sure everybody does at some point. But it gave me some clarity on, well, you know what? Just figure out what you want to do.
Yeah.
And my grandfather told me one thing when I was in high school, because he loved his job. And I could talk all day about my grandfather. And he said, it's really important to just do this. And this is my advice to you. Find something you love doing so much you never have to work a day in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he did. So did I.
Yeah. Yeah, lucky, right? One of the scenes that I remember is that your head, your heart, and your butt all have to be in the same place.
Yes.
Right?
Thank you.
And, you know, and I think that happens to a lot of people. And I think, unfortunately, in dentistry, it happens to a lot of people who aren't in dentistry, that while they know that's where they're supposed to be, like in their head, and their heart is not where they want to be right at that time. And I think that's where an educator like you comes in so valuable. And you're talking about your mom just being the continual learner. And what I have found is that people who sort of shy away or back away from the learning, when they get re-engaged into learning, that's when their heart and their head get back in sync into this world, this wonderful world of dentistry that we have. Would you agree, or your thoughts on that?
Absolutely, totally agree. And it's sort of a thing that's been exciting me a little bit lately. I'm not going to name names or go into detail, but my situation changed. Initially, I thought, you know, that was not of my doing. But when what you just said about your heart, your head, and your butt, is when your heart and your head kind of aren't in a place anymore, your butt finds a way to get out of there.
Yeah, right.
So you do things you don't even know you're doing that make something happen that changes things for you. And the reason I bring this up is this, because it fits right into that. I wrote there's a thing that we pass around with people who are Pinky alumni group. And this is from my days a long time ago. I was still contributing things in the 15 years that I was not there after I left there full time. And one of the things that I right after this all changed, and Leanne, and she said, are you going to come back and teach? And I said, you know, I don't. I feel uncomfortable a little bit coming in, and all of a sudden you're going to invite me to come back when there's other people who have spent the last 15 years kind of recreating that place and making it be what it is. And it's an awesome place. I'm uncomfortable with that. And she said, she looked up at me, and I'll never forget this. She said, you know what? I don't even really like baseball. But if I owned a baseball team and I had a shortstop that was really, really good, and they went and did something else for a while and they wanted to come back, I'd probably make them on the team. So let me go back. And I got to thinking about this. In some learning, people believe, and I'm going to say even the people doing the teaching believe, that it's about going and doing and checking something off. And what I've learned is that the kind of learning that you can do lots of places and with lots of people in dentistry, the ones that stick around and the ones that become, and I'm going to say the most valuable to the people who become involved in that, they enroll themselves in it, it becomes part of what they do. It's not about doing, it's about being. And the thing about being is that it doesn't end.
Right.
And it's why I am perfectly comfortable for years and did it. I'd go back anytime Pete Dawson got anywhere near me. and just sit down and listen. And somebody said, haven't you been to that before? I said, yeah, about six times. So why do you go back? I said, every time is different.
Yep. You're different. You're different. And maybe the words don't come out. Yeah. Right.
Even
the same way.
I have a good story about that. I was privileged to be able, when I was practicing and I was on the visiting faculty, to go for a period of time to all of what was the TMD, TMJ then, but with Parker Mahan at the Panker Institute. I would be the assistant. And that was 10 years that I got to do that with him when he was there. And I'd go and I would sit every time and I would listen. And when we went out for dinner at his last one afterwards, and I said to him, it was just him and me out to dinner. I said, one of the best gifts I've been given in life is this last 10 years to be able to sit here and hear all the stuff you brought into that program over the last 10 years. And he started laughing and he said, you know, there's probably only six words I changed in that whole thing in 10 years. And I said, I looked at him and he said, and never begins, because he was such a neat man. He looked at me and he said, the difference wasn't that stuff. It was you. You were different every time you showed up.
Totally. Yep.
And that's what I keep thinking about, is that the best places to learn are places that live, not places that do this thing and check it off.
Yeah.
They're alive, because the learning doesn't end. And it's why it was really fun, and still is fun, to be able to share things. And when you get to a place where people can be, you get everybody to join in that.
Right.
And sharing the stuff that they're learning. And that's what's powerful to me about learning organizations. And unfortunately, you know, some places you just want to check off a list. And, well, I don't want to dig a hole.
Right.
And I don't want to say mean things about anybody, and I wish no other places any negative anything.
Yeah.
But when it becomes about transmission of information, mm-hmm. and that's the only thing, and it becomes just a transactional relationship.
Right.
The real value of education gets lost, and it becomes just training.
Yeah.
And that's different than education for me.
Well, and I think you're right. I know you're right. And part of our problem is our educational system is set up that you check the boxes, right? You go,
absolutely.
You know, ask me what I remember about my anthropology degree that I was getting, right? I can barely, you know, I can't even spell Ramapithecus anymore, you know, even say it, even though I was getting an anthropology degree, right? Because I was checking off boxes. And that's sort of how we are educated, but that's not really how we learn.
Yes.
Right. We learn through mentorship and through, you know, people who are willing to allow us to say this, or who are willing to say the same thing over and over, so that we can listen to it and hear it over and over until it starts to become part of our understanding. And when you're in when it's a educational system that is just checking the boxes, as you say, there's no time for that. There's no room for that. There's no meter for that. And so the metrics are different, I think.
I totally agree. And it's why lifelong, you know, the thing about lifelong learning is, first of all, lifelong learning, it's impossible to be alive and not have lifelong learning. You can't, even people who aren't interested in going and seeking it are learning things every day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not. When you seek it, which I'd like to label intentional learning, because you do it with intention. It's not just the stuff that happens normally in life. That's exactly what has to happen, because I think you integrate things.
Right.
One of the things I love to say to people is, you know, if I get a chance, if you want me to come in and do something, you know, what do you guys want to talk about?
Yep.
And I'll say, because it's okay with me if you're looking for infotainment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can do that, you know.
Yep.
I hope that if you decide that there's something you really want to think about, I'd love to come. Because then what I know is going to happen, I'm going to learn as much as you learn.
Right.
I don't mind being in infotainment. I have a fun time with that.
Yeah.
That's fun. I have a good time, you know, trying to entertain people. One of my best friends who had never heard me do something in front of a group, you know, and it brings me energy and it brings me excitement. I love to see faces light up about anything. And he said, you know, you bring a lot of stuff to the room. And I said, I get way more than I give.
Yeah. Man,
it's amazing. When you're with a group of people who are with you and, and then it's really fun to hear them. That's my favorite kinds of things to do.
Totally agree. So, all right. I want to backtrack because I'm curious from you come back from your journey around the country. And at some point you must have started getting itchy, like, all right, I got to get back and get refocused, right? I mean, I can imagine that scratch, right? That itch that you got to scratch. Do you remember how long you were in your journey when you're like, okay, this has been great, but I got to get back to reality?
I worked at Whirlpool, saved some money. And I had another, you know, pivotal experience with a man who was there. And I spent one of the summers, I bid on a job because I was a younger guy, but I bid on this job that nobody bid on. It was a porcelain application operator. So you had to put on a suit, plug in an air hose and this head thing, and you go into a booth. This is before robots. And I was spraying porcelain on dishwasher tubs. So I have a squirt gun, like a paint gun is what it was. It was just like a paint gun. You paint this stuff on. The guy next to me who was putting on the stippling. The stippling is the little bits of color that are mixed in. They're little dots. I don't know if you ever looked on a porcelain surface.
Yes, sure.
The reason you stipple it is so that imperfections in the glass when it gets baked aren't as obvious.
Oh, okay.
See any little ripples or any stuff in the glass. So he was stippling. And he had been an employee for a long time. He was probably... Oh, God, he had to be like 55 years old. And we did this for 8 hours, you can imagine. So I'm plugging into this thing. I mean, this is before there were earphone things.
Right, sure.
There's nothing.
Right. 8 hours.
Well, you get a break. You got a break before lunch. You had a half an hour lunch, and then you had another 15-minute break. If you didn't smoke, you wanted to, because that was a reason to go do something else. Then make sure you get your break. What I did do, by the way, for that whole summer was, I was a big Beatles fan. I got so that I could go through and sing all of the songs on every Beatle album, starting with the first one, going all the way through to the last one that had been published. And I could do it forward or backward. You could start me anywhere in the middle.
Using your time wisely, I can tell.
Had to have something going in my head. It made me crazy. Anyway, so this guy hated his job.
Yeah.
We'd get there, we'd put stuff on. He would just he'd be bitching about it all the whole time. This place sucks. Da, 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 da. And I looked at him and I said, Paul, if you hate it that much, why don't you just quit and go do something else? And he totally went off. And I mean, literally said, oh, yeah, Mr. College Boy, you're never going back. Just wait and see. Da, da, da. All this stuff went on. And I said, listen, I mean this sincerely. Let's both walk up front and give our notice, because I don't hate it, but I also realize I think the reason I don't hate it is because, yeah, I'm going to go back to school. And you're right. Maybe now's the time. So at the lunch break, the line stops at the lunch break because there's nobody to spray the stuff on that ain't happening.
Right.
So we walk up to the front, and it was kind of a place I knew pretty much everybody. It was a pretty big plant. But the people up front who ran the place were actually people who got out and talked to everybody. I mean, we knew the director of HR. He was a neat guy. I liked him. And I walk into the office and I'm talking to, I think Betty was the lady who was there at the time. And yeah, he's right here. Let me grab him for you. And I turn around and he's gone. Paul's gone.
I got your back.
So I gave my notice, and he tried to talk me out of it. He said, look, you know, because here's what happened. They had offered me a scholarship to college.
Okay.
I would go and I could go to school. I would be paid as part of my job to go to school and then also to come and work in the plant.
Sure.
But I had to major in business and or management, quote unquote. They were two different things at that point, I think.
Yep.
And I remember looking at him and I said, I'm on. But you guys would, that's awesome. And that, I mean, this is the kind of place I think I would love to work. But I really love science. And I don't know if I want to do this kind of stuff for the rest of my life where I'm doing this. And so I declined. And I gave him my 2 weeks' notice and I went back to school. By the way, when I graduated from dental school, I went back and I found Paul. And he had literally just retired. I went to his retirement party because he was finally done. Been there long enough that he could quit. That's what he'd been working for.
Right.
And he was dead in 6 months.
Yeah.
He died of a heart attack.
Same old story.
Isn't it amazing?
Same old story.
The thing that he hated so much was the only reason he was keeping himself alive. And I know he did. That's not really what he was thinking ever. That's what the reality is.
Right.
And there's some really good, as you know, there's some really good research out there around that. That's what happens to people. And it's why my grandfather's advice was so wise.
Right.
So anyway, I did that. So I went back to school. My younger brother had caught me by then. The reason I also got a chemistry major with my biology major is because he was a chemistry major. And both of us did really, really well in organic chemistry. I love organic chemistry. It's very visual. And I could see, I still can do this. I love to look at, I can see the molecule. I can see when the bond breaks, where that would come in and how it would bond and all this stuff. In fact, one of the weirdest experiences of my life is when my youngest daughter was in college, and she is now a dentist. We were in the car driving somewhere, and I said, "So, how's it going?" She said, "Oh, organic chemistry, it's just awesome. I love it. You know, they're talking about all the stuff it's doing, and I can see it happening in my head." I never had told her any of this stuff. It was awesome. By the way, analytical chemistry, I'm terrible because it's arithmetic.
Right.
I'm awful at that stuff. But anything I can see in my head. My brother had caught me. He also kind of had, he loved it as well. That, by the way, is still his. He owns several chemical companies. They make stuff, they do foundry releasing agents.
Cool.
He had come. And so we worked together in a lab and got interested. And the reason I even took the DAT is that my younger brother thought he wanted to be a dentist. And at that time, we had to go to Cleveland to take a DAT. You had to go to a testing center and take this. And he said, "Why don't you come and take this test with me? You know, you've done the same stuff. Let's go take it." So we go take this test. He paid for it.
All right.
So we got our scores back. And at the time, they did these scores. I think the mean was 4, and the score could be 1 through 9.
-1 to 9.
I'm sorry?
I think it was -1 to 9.
-1 to 9. And my brother, we got our things. I went and I took it, and I thought that was a fun test. And, you know, I love, by the way, I loved test taking. One of my educational things I really enjoyed was test and measurement. And so took the test, and my brother got his back. He kind of finished in the middle. He had like 4s and 5s, and I had several 9s and 2 8s. And I thought, wow, that's as good as I've done on a test. And I got a letter with it saying, you know, congratulations, you've done extremely well on this exam. And so I started visiting dental practices. And by the
This is
way,
a crazy story, Gary. So
yeah.
I've heard lots of stories how people get into dentistry and they're, you know, a lot of the influence, like someone talked about it. Oh, that sounds, you know, dentistry, I could see that. But I've never heard anyone say, I just went and took a test. I did really well on it. So that's how I chose my career. That's insane.
Well, in fairness, I started going to visit dentists, and I went to visit my dentist in Toledo. And he was a really nice man. He had been a friend of my parents. And so I asked him, I called the office and said, "Can I come?" And when he got me into the office, of course, I haven't seen the other stuff in the office. This guy did all of his own waxing. I mean, he made all of his own dentures. He did all of this stuff. And I remember watching him doing this stuff, and I've always loved doing stuff with my hands. I just started to see that it wasn't just standing out there with those people. It was all this other stuff. It was cool. And I really liked that and enjoyed it. And he had me go and watch. He said, "Well, I'm going to have you go over and talk to Dr. So-and-so. I didn't remember the guy's name, but he was a neurosurgeon. I almost fainted, by the way. I got to go in and put on a gown and stuff. And tooth comes out and there's lots of blood for this one. And I remember it was like, I got all a little bit dizzy and he turned, looked over at me and he asked. I do remember his assistant's name because he said, Marlene, why don't you give Gary a chair? I know. By the way, it doesn't bother me at all now.
But yeah. For six
anyway, that's sort of how I kind of thought this could be really something I would enjoy.
Huh.
And as I said, then, you know, it turned out to be.
So, yeah.
But oh, it's crazy. Honestly the impetus for me to learn more about it, because it fits. It's biology. It's yep. chemistry. I mean, it's physics, which I didn't even think about initially.
Mm-hmm.
Later, lots of stuff came in. That's physics. That's cool.
I like being able to see how things work in your head. I mean, that's such a big, vital part of what we do, right?
Yes, sir. Exactly.
Yeah. That's so cool.
So that's how I wound up at dental school.
So funny. And you end up going to Case Western, right, for dental school?
I did.
You did your 4 years there.
Were you
and then, and by the way, so we had, I was at Michigan and I graduated in 88. And then we had people who transferred over. And it was around that time the dean of the dental school had been arrested for some big insurance fraud stuff going on. Do you remember that?
So.
Is that your dean?
That's him. Tom DeMarco.
That's it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was the, I got active in the student government at the dental school when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was never a class officer. I was our class representative my first year to the dental school government body. And then what you would have is the president and the vice president of the class, and then two other representatives. So I said, I just want to be a representative to that one. So I did that. And so in my third and fourth year, I was the president of the student body. My second one as a sophomore as the VP of the whole student government.
Okay.
And then I got to do it. And the reason that was really useful is that at Case, 100% of the activity fees that were part of your tuition,
yeah,
they gave to the student government of that school.
All right.
So in 1977, 77, I really would have, 77, 78, I would have been the VP. So the next year, 78, 79, 79, 80. I had a budget of about $85,000 to do stuff with at the dental school.
Holy cow.
And to travel with the dean as a representative of the dental school.
Okay.
So in my third year, I travel all over places with Tom DeMarco. Learned a lot from Tom DeMarco.
Yeah, I bet you did.
And it was one of those deals where, you know, in hindsight, here's what I think. I appreciated him. I enjoyed being with him. How do you say this? I learned that when you begin to make any sort of moral compromises, that in your brain somewhere you know they are, mm-hmm. other compromises don't seem as compromising. How do I say that? He started having affairs and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it was obvious. I mean, he thought nobody knew.
Right.
Everybody knew.
Yeah.
And it was not long after that, because it got ugly at home, I guess, that he got into this business deal where they were kind of faking a leasing company. So these cars sort of didn't exist. They had fake titles and stuff. And then they would get wrecked or destroyed.
Right.
And they were collecting insurance money.
Yeah.
And I remember somebody asked me, said, you know, because he wasn't running that company. But he had, you know, it was a bunch of his money in there.
Yeah.
There's only, I think, three principals in the whole thing. And somebody asked me, and I said it honestly, and it wasn't to slam Dr. DeMarco or Tom. It wasn't to slam him. Nice. They said, you know, do you think he didn't know? And I said, he'll be smarter than that. He knew. I think he got sucked in because of all the other stuff that he had
Sure.
You know what happened in his life? And he was looking at a nasty, ugly divorce, and
he starts pulling a thread, and you know that thread just keeps on, pulling, and things start untangling, and that's what I had to ask you about.
One
that.
Of those deals where you go, "It's a shame," and I'm going to learn from that observation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, and to this day, I mean, that's the one thing that, and I struggle with still is, you know, never underestimate the power of one indiscretion. Make all other indiscretions not seem as indiscretions. Be careful.
In clinical practice, that's a reality, right?
Oh my goodness.
No one's looking.
Full reality.
Yeah.
That's what you got to be willing to say. I mean, this comes up all the time. Early in my career, I remember I've been thinking about that because not everything we do works.
No.
All right. So it's, you're at your practice and it's middle of the month. Mid-month payrolls due. Somebody comes in and there's a full coverage restoration that I put in not that long ago. These are the first bite wings. Because, you know, I immediately said when I got, I ain't taking an x-ray on every person I put a crown in on.
Yeah, I'd say the same.
To see if it's seated.
How silly.
Why would I want to zap them that much?
Yep.
Because if I do all their stuff right, it'll fit. So it comes in, you look at that first bite wing you've taken and you go, crap.
Golden margin.
And I remembered everything I had done for people in that chair. And you look at it and you go, yeah, that's fun. If it doesn't fit, what are you going to do? And I said, here, somebody asked me, actually I created it was a thing about values. And then it was a morality questionnaire.
Mm.
And I started it out the exercise by saying to a group of people, would you kill somebody? Of course, everybody says no.
No.
Right away. And I said, you have any kids? Yeah. Okay. So pick somebody who has a kid. They raise their hand and I say, so what's your oldest child's name? You take the name. And I say, we are somewhere and there is a locked gate. You can't come through the gate, but it's pretty open. I am about 10 feet inside that gate and I have Tommy against a wall with my hands on his throat. He's starting to turn blue and he's not kicking as much. You have a 44 Magnum. Would you kill somebody?
Right.
Without hesitation. Is that fair?
Yep.
And I said, can you see that all decisions create an instant of morality that is variable?
Yes, it is.
And the danger in what we do and what I do is when I look at that tooth in there and I think, well, it's not sensitive. And payroll's due this week. And tuition for the kids is due.
And you don't want to admit it to the patient. You don't want the patient to lose trust in you.
Yes.
Right.
Do you let it go? And I remember I said I came to a realization because that's a real life situation for me. And I turned to my patient and I said, this crown is open toward the back. And then I had to find a way to do something. And then I will tell you that the other part of everything that was going on then allowed me to say this, that I didn't say I was just going to do it over. I said, what I'd really like to do is I'd like to remove that. Put a provisional in there. Allow it some time to see how things react around there. And then we can go back and finish it later. Because I was really worried about paying the lab bill.
Yeah. Right.
And I said, here's what happens. If you're willing to set some parameters, just set them. Own them. And you'll figure out a way to make that be okay.
Yeah.
It'll work. Patient was totally fine and happy with it and actually said, well, it doesn't bother me. Do you really have to do it? I said, yeah. I said, at this point, honestly, you're letting me do it for me because it's not right.
Right.
There is a small chance that you could live for the next 50 years and nothing bad would happen to that dude.
Totally. Yep.
I'm just not comfortable with that. And that's important in all the areas of your life. And that's what I recognize. That's the lesson I learned from Dr. DeMarco. Don't be careful what you say is okay if it goes against your real values.
Yeah. When you graduate, so you and Cheryl got married in dental school. Did you guys have kids?
We got married and graduated in 1980.
Did you have children when you guys were in school?
No.
Okay. So you guys, when you graduated, I know Cheryl later goes on and gets an ortho degree from Tennessee, but you guys,
Cheryl, you started practice together as restorative general dentists for 20
in Toledo,
where she went back.
In Toledo, or where were you guys practicing?
Emeryville, Ohio. Okay. So a very small community, 800 homes, 1,200 people out in the country. We were about 50 miles outside, that's 46 miles outside Toledo.
Did you guys buy an established practice, or did you just start a practice from scratch, or how did you guys do that?
It had 36 patients.
So an established practice.
It was an established practice. There was a guy in Bowling Green, Ohio, which was 9 miles away.
Uh-huh.
He thought he wanted to have a satellite office, so he put this little office in Pemberville. It was three operatories. It's in the middle of a building in downtown Pemberville. Downtown Pemberville is a block and a half with buildings. And the building was built in 1868. And so it was 19 feet wide and about 90 feet deep.
Yeah.
And he put in three ops. And he started going out. He tried to go one day a week, and then he didn't enjoy doing that much. And so then he would go out occasionally. And so it was pretty new equipment. It had only probably been there a year or less. And then it was just like he didn't want to do it. And so Mir Dental, which was a dental supply company.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
From Detroit, actually from out by the airport, but being in Toledo, had an office in Toledo, so they were a supply company, and I had gotten acquainted with them because Cheryl and I were both working at a place in Findlay, Ohio. We just had gotten a job, and I started every time Jack from Mir Dental came to do anything, I watched what he was doing, and he loved to teach as well.
Mm.
And so because I wanted to learn about the equipment and the
sure.
stuff, and I was just interested in it. How are you going to fix that? Was what I wanted to know. And so we got to know each other, you know, you talk. And he called me one day and he said, there is a little practice in a little town that you should go look at. I'm not sure if you're married to being in a middle-sized town. Findlay was about 50,000 people. Or you'd be okay in a small community. I'm just going to tell you, as a guy who's been around dentists and dental offices my whole life, you seem to me like a guy who would do great in a town where you could get to know everybody who's there.
Mm-hmm.
And you will have a way easier time creating a practice that you want in a place like that. Than if you stay in a place where it takes a while to build a reputation, because you will build an immediate reputation.
Right.
If you go up here, in fact, you don't have a choice about getting a reputation.
Right.
Good or bad.
Right. Good or bad.
So I went and I looked at this place, and Cheryl and I both looked at it, and I still remember, I said, yeah, what do you think? So we went and visited Pemberville, and we both kind of liked it. So we wound up buying that practice. Cheryl got a job in Toledo because there's only 36 patients. We figured it would take probably a year or two to build it into something. I will tell you that 3 months later, I said, you need to quit your job in Toledo, because I was getting, you know, 40, 50 new patients calling every month.
Wow, that's fantastic.
How cool is that? It was amazing. And he was right. He just said that these people are looking for somebody all around here. Because even though it was on country, There's a farmhouse every half mile.
Right.
But it was small farm. So there's lots of people out there in the country, you know, that part of Ohio. And so Cheryl came back and we got busy, and that was in 1985. And then in 1989, because we were in there for 4 years, and we used to do a split day. One of the things that I committed to was that as much as possible, I worked really, really hard to make sure that Cheryl and I were 50-50 in this deal.
Mm-hmm.
And there, that meant I had to be 50-50 in the marriage and the kids and all that stuff. So we worked out a schedule where one of us was home all the time. We do half the days and we split the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we were real busy. And so we built an office. And when we built the office, then we decided, you know, probably time to get a nanny.
Mm-hmm.
So we can be there at the same time because that'll be more fun. And it's yeah. That's what we wound up doing. We built a building in 1988, 89, and stayed there until 2000. I left in 2003. Cheryl had been gone for about a year and a half.
Hey, Dental Online Trainers, thank you for tuning back in to our SureCast episode with Dr. Gary DeWood. This episode is a two-part interview, so if you missed the first part, please go check it out on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. So kick back, relax, and enjoy the rest of this conversation with Dr. Gary DeWood.